Okay, and I'm just recording the audio, so don't worry, I'm not recording the video or anything like that. I'd like to welcome everybody to the second conference call for RM103 and acknowledge that I'm hosting it from the traditional territory of the Kwamundun First Nation and Tonkwatchin Council. This week, what I'm going to do, you may or may not have noticed that I've given you next week off from the conference call, but it is a time to work with your fellow lawyer on your case. So you can choose. Peter's going to work with Kayla, so Peter, if Kayla doesn't jump on this call, you'll have to reach out to her. And Spider and David, you guys at the end of the call, you're welcome to choose whether to meet at the same time next week and work on your case, or if you want to do it in a different way. So we'll wrap up the end of the call with that. So that means for today's conference call, I'm going to cover content from week two and from week three. So I may be going at a fairly rapid pace, so please use the chat if you want me to slow down or if you have any questions about anything, and I'm happy to take the time to stop. So last week, we familiarized ourselves with some terminology that was related to legal risk, and we talked about four factors or issues that are used to determine negligence. This week, we're going to examine four types of liability that determine who is responsible for negligence. So you move into who's responsible once negligence has been established. So keep that in mind when you're working on your court cases. And then we're going to move on and say, okay, so if somebody is responsible for the negligence that took place, what are three ways that a defendant can use to escape liability? And we'll look at the fourth way in the fourth week. We can do a quick introduction, but what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to share an example from your RLA that you did last week about how you show a duty of care. And I just want to clarify that because, Peter, you did ask the question about the difference between duty of care and standard of care. So let's just pick one example that you used. And if you can't remember what it is, don't worry, I've got them written down in front of me. So before you do that, I just want to remind you that a duty of care is one of the first things that they'll look at to determine negligence. And it arises because there's a relationship between two parties. So David's running a walking program later, and David has a relationship as the leader to the participants that are in his program. Okay? Spider, when you're coaching or if you're the executive director of an association that has coaches, you have a relationship with those people that are participating in your program. And so when this is an evident or a very clear relationship, it's your duty to foresee and to prevent any injury or damages. And then the last thing that they will do is look and see if you breached that because you didn't adhere to an acceptable standard of care. So the duty to care is about the relationship, and the standard of care is around what's expected out in the world. So hopefully that kind of makes a little bit of sense. So Peter, you jumped on first, so we'll go with Peter, Spider, and David. Peter, if you remember, do you want to pull one example of a duty of care that you included in your last week's post?
I think it was to request and review certification of our real leaders, specifically our independent contractors. Would that be...
Yeah, so your duty of care then, by requesting certifications, you're actually extending and saying that you have a duty of care for the people that are going to participate in programs that RPAY funds. So you're
okay.
taking that one step further. Yeah, so your relationship in that example is with the people who are going to participate in the program. So you're making sure that that person is certified and will deliver a good program. And so it's important because you're not actually there in person. So that's a good way of establishing it. And the standard of care that would go along with that is that if somebody is doing, say, a fitness program, there's certain standards out there about certifications that are expected from people. RPA might also have a standard of care that certification, a first aid certification is expected. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and so the standard of care, it can be sort of a standard that is set from like across the board for all organizations running similar programming, but it could also be specific standards that we set as an organization, like unique to us.
Exactly. So a standard of care is usually determined, I think we talked about last week, it's on slide 17, about things that are published standards. So aquatics has published standards. If you have a pool, you must have so many lifeguards for that size of pool or for the people that are taking part, right? So that is published. There's industry practices. So it's all three of you, I think, collect certifications. So that would be a practice. It's not written in a standard nationally, but the standard might be that you don't offer fitness courses without a certain level of certification. So there's different ways. I guess what I'm saying is there's different ways that standards of care are expressed, and they're not always clear. Sometimes you have to find out what other people are doing and not do something totally different, but do something consistent with what the industry or the sector is doing. So hopefully that makes a bit more sense.
Yeah, no, for sure. There's just a little bit of the language that clarifies, yeah.
It is, and if you think of the duty of care as the relationship for the people that are using your facilities or taking part in your programs, and then the standard of care is sort of what the courts might deem as acceptable or not, the level above or the level below, and they look to other organizations, not just to your own organization, to establish that standard.
All right, okay. Thank you.
I know it is confusing. It took me a bit to reread it all so I could try and explain it. So, for your patience. Spider, for yourself, what was one duty of care that you came up with? Oh, you're on mute. I can see your voice and your mouth moving.
I don't have it in front of me, but I remember talking about a recreation facility, for example, in a Nuvik, or NWT Squash gave the Rec Association goggles, so that anybody who rented a racket, they got a complimentary pair of goggles, so that the I don't know how to explain it, but the standard of care was that, if you're going to play, then if you're a minor, then you have to wear goggles. And if you're an adult, you can choose whether or not to wear them, but they're strongly recommended. And then we elevated that by making them free, so you weren't nickel and dime if you wanted to, go and rent. You have to rent a racket, you got to buy a ball, and goggles are $3. Well, okay, I'll just get the racket and the ball. We don't want to contribute to them being unsafe, so that's why we said, okay, we'll provide the goggles. And in fact, for our junior programs with the racket, all our squash locations in Newark, Fort Smith, and Yellowknife, we buy boxes of goggles so that if they go in a squash program as a junior, then you get a complimentary pair of goggles.
So your duty of care then is to your young participants, and it's to make sure that they're safe and they know what appropriate safety gear is. And you're probably following a standard that is established across the country. I imagine that other organizations make sure that youth are wearing appropriate eye protection when they're playing squash.
Yes.
So it's an industry standard then. Okay, that's great. Thank you. David, you might need to unmute as well. I see you're muted too. So what was one that you included?
Well, I really like spiders because it reminded me of a standard of care and a duty of care that I brought in at Beringia Center. But I'll just, duty of care, like here in my office, I put make sure that the areas are clear or void of hazards like cords, sticking out, other basic tripping hazards. That's just the environmental duty of care. If somebody comes into my office, they should not have to be concerned, or if somebody is working in the office, they should not have to be concerned about tripping hazards. An example of this also would go as far as any bookshelves, things of that nature, are attached to the walls just in case there's an earthquake. So following set guidelines, and many of these guidelines are set out through the Operational Health and Safety Standards, WCB, and so by following, and this is what I put down, by following published standards. So in this case, the example I used was if you're doing hiking, then you look at proper footwear. In other words, in today's weather, you talked about yak tracks. Well, I know with the walks I've been leading with the Nordic Walks, I look at their footwear, and I offer the yak tracks available to them. In other words, I'm looking at, are they wearing the proper footwear for the activity that they're going to undertake?
Awesome. So you're carrying out a duty of care to your participants, but it's probably, if we looked at other walking programs, it would probably be consistent with what other walking programs like an NWT would do. So the duty of care is the relationship you have with those people and how you carry that out. And the standard of care is, if they looked across the board, you're doing what is expected of you. Perfect.
Yes,
thank you.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Thanks so much. So hopefully that's a little bit clearer for everyone, because that's why I asked you the question last week. So thanks. So now let's assume that all four conditions are satisfied. Oh, and I'm just going to let you know I'm on slide 22. That's where I'm starting on, just in case you have the slides open in front of you. So let's assume that we satisfied all four conditions and there is negligence. The next question that the courts will ask is, who is liable or who is responsible for that negligence? So you might recall from last week that negligence is about conduct or behavior, but liability is about responsibility for what happened as a result of the behavior. So it's really important to remember that these two are very closely connected, but they are not the same thing. So liability, okay, is about who is responsible for what happened, okay, whereas negligence is about the conduct or behavior. So they're very closely linked, but they're not the same thing. So first of all, if something goes wrong, the courts are going to figure out, was there negligence? Was somebody behaving or not behaving in a responsible way, and were there damages? Then the next question, they'll say, well, if that happened, who was responsible for it, or who was liable for it, for the negligent behavior? And this is what's interesting. So keep this in mind when you're doing your mock trials or court cases. Responsibility is not always assigned to the person who's negligent. It's not a cut or dry, you're right, I'm wrong, you're negligent, I'm not situation. And that's because there's different types of liability or responsibility. So this is a really important piece for people in recreation to understand. So there are four common types of liability, and they're shown on slide 22. Personal, vicarious. Yeah, go ahead, David.
I was trying to write down that quote, and I really liked it. Responsibility is not always assigned to the who?
To the person or persons who had the negligent behavior or demonstrated the negligent behavior. And remember, I'm recording the call, and if there's any key points like that, I can also combine them into a message afterwards, like a written message, so you can keep track of it. Thanks for waving at me. I can totally see both you and Spider on the screen, so good to interrupt if you have a question. So responsibility, then, is not always assigned to the person who's found negligent. So we have to think of these four different types. There's other types, but these are the four main types. personal vicarious occupiers and products. And I'm going to explain each one really clearly and give you an example of each one. So these different types of liability are used to determine who was responsible. And in a lawsuit, a judge might say that more than one person or more than one organization was responsible, but a judge might also say that there's more than one type of liability involved. So you might have vicarious and occupier's liability in a lawsuit. So this is why it starts to get complicated. And again, you'll have a chance to work through this when you do your mock cases. Excuse me. So let's take a look at slide 23 that talks about personal liability. There's not a lot on there, so I'll explain it a little bit more. And remember, there is an activity in it's activity number 5 that will explain this in more detail. So personal liability, as you can see on slide 23, is the first thing that they're going to look at. If the courts determine that an individual is negligent, that individual can be held personally, and the keyword can, be held personally liable for their behavior and for the resulting damages. So here's an example. So a yoga instructor, and actually I'm going to pop this in the chat so you guys can also read it if you want to as well. So a yoga instructor needs personal insurance because if there is a lawsuit during which the yoga instructor is found personally liable, and if the instructor does not have insurance or not enough insurance, the courts will require that instructor to pay the amount awarded or the difference. So that's personal, like that person did something wrong. Maybe they're offering their own yoga classes, not under an organization like the Game Center, not under an organization that has insurance for them. So without that personal insurance, if they do something that's negligent, they're fully responsible or could be found fully responsible for damages. So once personal liability has been established, the courts are then going to move on and ask, was that person an employee, a volunteer, or had some type of relationship with an organization? So Peter, Real Leaders are an example. They're not an employee of RPAY, and they're not volunteers, but they have a relationship with RPAY. If David, if you have any other people leading, walking for you, they have a relationship with ERA because they're running programs for you. So then we start to look into a second type of liability shown on slide 24, which is vicarious liability. So if an employee or volunteer or any of these people acts on behalf of an organization or an employer, vicarious liability can come into effect. So an employer can be responsible or vicariously liable for the actions of an employee with some exceptions. So in other words, when Peter said that he's checking out the certifications of his instructors, if he lets somebody teach a fitness course and hasn't verified their certification, and something happens, that person might be personally liable, but RPAY might also be vicariously liable. So really important to understand vicarious liability. The responsibility exists, though, only if the employee is acting within the scope of responsibility and there's no deliberate attempt to injure. So in other words, that person's negligence found, but the person who's an employee is acting with what we would consider as reasonable behavior, then it can kick over to the employer being responsible. And it always, vicarious liability always kicks in unless there's gross negligence. But gross negligence is really difficult to prove, so it seldom comes up in court. So I'm going to put another example in the chat, and I'm going to read it to you at the same time. I like this example. This is a kind of a cool example of personal and vicarious liability. So in an Ontario lawsuit, an individual was injured because the ice surface in the arena was not thick enough. The judge found the city negligent and awarded $5 million to the plaintiff, the person who got injured. The city turned around and appealed the lawsuit, and the judge turned around and increased the decision to $7.5 million. Guess they shouldn't have appealed it. But the city only had $5 million liability insurance. So what did they do next? They determined that the employee, the person responsible for the ice surface, had training and had experience. So from the $7.5 million award, the city could have turned around and sued that employee for the $2.5 million difference. So they could have said, yes, we'll accept $5 million responsibility, but our employee is $2.5 million responsible too under personal liability. So that's an example of where there could have been a combination of personal and vicarious liability. Fortunately for that employee, the city was pretty good to them, and they increased taxes for all the taxpayers instead of holding that employee responsible for the $2.5 million. So vicarious liability, and this is really important for all of you in your organizations, vicarious liability also applies to your volunteers. So this is why having a formalized volunteer agreement, especially in larger organizations or for larger events like the Arctic Winter Games, is a good idea. Many small organizations don't have formal volunteer agreements in place. So in this case, the courts might ask for proof of certification, like Peter mentioned at the beginning of the call, or they might confirm that that person is indeed filling a volunteer role by asking, can you confirm that Susan is a volunteer with the gymnastics club or the squash club? Organizations generally carry general liability insurance because of vicarious liability. So all of your organizations will cover your staff and also your employees. Some organizations like ARPA also cover contractors, but that is unusual. NWTRPA does not have that in their general liability insurance. So let's move on to the third type. I don't see anybody, Natalie, waving at me yet. So let's look at occupier's liability on slide 25. So with occupier's liability, the court will decide if negligence was due to the premises or the facility or to the activity that was taking place in that facility or premises. So if they determine that negligence was due to the premises, it means that the person who owns the facility is at fault. So if somebody hurts themselves, spider in the building that Sport North Federation rents from whoever the owner of the building is, maybe it's the government, I don't know who owns your building, and somebody hurts themselves in that building and it was found that there's something wrong in your building, then the owner's at fault. However, if it's the activity that is found to have caused the damage, then the user group, the group who has rented or used the facility to run an activity, might be at fault. So if you're an owner of a building, you will have general liability insurance for your building, for your facilities, for your playground, for your parks. However, groups who use your facility don't always have insurance. So we know that some small groups find it really hard to get insurance. So if consider that a group who uses your facility, so let's say, David, you guys have a boardroom at Elder Active. Let's say you let a group come in there and run, they're running like a fitness class in there and you don't know it, right? You've let them come in. They don't have any insurance or anything like that. If something happened and someone was injured and the group was found to be negligent or even partially negligent, they could be held liable or partially liable. So normally if they had insurance, it might fall to their insurance. However, if they don't have insurance, can you imagine whose insurance it's going to go under? Under yours as the owner of the facility. So somebody always pays. It's usually a matter of who actually pays. And that's why it's not cut and dry. It's never 100% and 0%. Sometimes there's combinations. So let's go to slide 26, and then I have some questions for you after this one. So slide 26 introduces product liability. And this is really important if you're using different products like Spider. In the last time we did the proposal writing, you were talking about wheelchairs. So that might fall under here. Peter, you've worked in a weight room, so that might fall under this one too. So under products liability, the manufacturer, the installer, or the owner could be liable if there's damages. So if an injury or damage was caused because there was a defect and the manufacturer is found responsible, then the insurance that the manufacturer has covers the damage. So if you install some weight room equipment and something's faulty and it was deemed to be the manufacturer, then their insurance covers it. But if the damage or injury was caused by owner error, so maybe you modified or put that equipment together incorrectly and you didn't follow the instructions, then the organization who owns or who's purchased that might be found at fault, and then your general liability insurance will kick in to cover damages. So I have a question for you, and the question, I'll pop it in the chat and I'll read it out for Peter. Peter, we'll let you go last. We'll start with Spider and then go to David and then to Peter. So what is, just to share one thing here because I still have lots to go through today. So what is one thing that you should do when you purchase, install, or repair equipment? Spider, any thoughts? What's one thing that you should always do when you purchase, install, and or repair equipment?
Complete any warranty information?
Sure. So that just means that if something happens to it, you have that paperwork in place and you can go back to the manufacturer, right?
And that is, for example, we put a wood stove in the house 4 or 5 years ago, and it needed to be put in by somebody who maybe it was the chimney install that had to have a particular designation for putting in wood stove chimneys for our insurance to cover any subsequent problem. Our insurer obliged that the person who was putting it in had to be WHET, I think, certified in the installation of the wood stove and its chimney.
Exactly. So, you know, you're doing your warranty, but you're also making sure that you have a certified person installing it. Thank you. David, any other thoughts about what you should do when you purchase, install, or repair equipment? Oh, you're muted.
Read the instructions.
Thank you. Sometimes that doesn't happen, right? So read the instructions.
Yeah.
That's really important.
Yeah, I always read the instructions just because, okay, the first one or two pages are always hazard this, hazard that, don't do this, don't do that. So just educating yourself. It's not too difficult to forget to unplug your computer before you open the back. You know, that type of stuff. So, and I also keep the instruction booklets handy for future reference. So they're there for a reason.
Exactly. And that means not only following the instructions when you're setting it up, but also, as I just popped in the chat here, only adjusting it if it's in accordance with those instructions. So don't make modifications or changes unless it's specified in those instructions. Peter, this sort of piece really applies to RPA's Winter Active for Life equipment program. So is there anything else that comes to your mind about what you should do when you purchase, install, or repair equipment?
Document everything. essentially, document when you purchase it, document when you maintain it, and document when you fix it. Just to cover your own.
I'll trade it.
Just to show that you have some sort of it's probably a duty of care, basically, ensuring the equipment is being maintained correctly.
Excellent, thanks. So just sort of make sure you document it. The other points I have here are make sure that you inspect equipment that you purchase, because we do a lot of shipping of equipment up north. So if you just unwrap it, the packaging, and assume that it's safe to use, you potentially could be liable if something is broken or not working properly. So inspect it after shipping it. And also, as Spider mentioned, like, make sure that you have a qualified person to install it. And if you don't have a qualified person to install it, find out, you know, contact the manufacturer. Like, that's probably with bigger equipment, but just make sure that, you know, you contact them if you have any doubts. And as Peter said, document it. So those are four types of liability, or four ways people can be responsible. I'm just going to, if there's no immediate questions, I'm going to zip into week three content, and then I have a couple more questions in here for you. Yes, go ahead, Spider.
Sometimes as well, noting that you know, the person who's installing it needs to be certified, but they need to be familiar, intimately familiar with the hazards of the equipment that they're using, for example. So if I run a squash club and I want to get the court sanded, and then I pick somebody who I know is competent in sanding courts, but the sander itself, you know, because you're capturing ultra-hot, you know, wood particles and stuff, you need to know that, you know, don't let the sawdust bag get more than half full, because you don't want to have the risk of spontaneous combustion, so that they need to know that, hey, that's it's a hazard for me to, you know, keep going beyond having a half full bag of the sawdust. Because, you know, it's at risk of catching fire, potentially. It doesn't happen very often, but, you know, the installer needs to be aware of that risk. So we need to know that the installer is strong, but they're also familiar with the hazards of their equipment.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. So we're going to move on, and what I'd like to look at is three of the four ways that a defendant might be able to escape liability. So I've jumped ahead to slide 29 here. And we're going to look at the first three, and then we'll look at number four in the last week. So slide 29 shows you that even if there's negligence and you're found liable, you might be able to escape that liability to a certain extent, more or less, if the plaintiff or the person who was injured or ill, if their own actions contributed to the injury. If the plaintiff voluntarily assumed risk of injury, and or if the plaintiff signed a valid waiver form. So now we're coming back to waivers that we covered in our last learning event. So let's look at these three things. So the first thing is about, and these are big words, contributory negligence. So it's described on slide 30 and also in activity 8. So take some time to go through those extra activities, because there's more information in there. To establish this type of negligence is focused on the plaintiff or the person who's claiming that there was damage or injury on their behavior. So keep this in mind when you're looking at your mock court case and preparing your cases. So people, even though you provide facilities and programs, people who use your facilities and participate in your activities are still expected to take reasonable care. They're not expected to climb on the outside of railings and jump off balconies and things like that. They're expected to behave in a reasonable manner. So if a person's behavior led to their injury, this person, who would be the plaintiff, may be partially liable. They might not be 100%, or they might be. So there might be some liability there. So the courts want to look at this thing called contributory negligence. And they're going to ask three questions, and I'll pop these in the chat just so that you can see what they are. So the questions are, how much of a factor was the plaintiff's behavior in the outcome and the damages? So was the plaintiff just way out in left field and their behavior completely caused it, or was it just partially? To what extent could the plaintiff be expected to take reasonable care given factors such as age and ability? So obviously we don't have the same expectation of children as we do of competent adults. we might not have the same expectation of people who are under the influence of drugs or alcohol as we would for somebody who was not. So different expectations there about what reasonable care would be. We also might be reasonable in somebody who uses a weight room 5 days a week. We might expect different behavior from them to somebody who has just used it for the first time. So the courts will also ask, would the accident have happened or been less severe if the plaintiff had acted differently? So if a plaintiff is found to be contributory negligent, usually the settlement is reduced proportionally. So what that means is if a plaintiff is found 10% negligent, then the settlement of $1 million is reduced by 10% to $900,000. So here's an example, and I'll pop this in the chat and read it, from Ontario that actually happened to give you an example of contributory negligence. So an individual dove into a pool off a diving board and came into contact with a submerged safety wall, and it resulted in serious injury. I'm sure you can imagine diving into a pool and hitting a submerged safety wall would hurt a lot. In the lawsuit, the plaintiff claimed negligent construction of the pool. So they said the pool was not constructed appropriately, and saying that the submerged wall constituted a hidden danger. But in court, they found that the plaintiff was an experienced swimmer who knew that the safety wall was there. The court had also determined that the swimming pool was a modern design, so they were looking at industry standards, and had been supervised during its construction by a competent engineer. So it was, they built the pool in accordance with the standards. So the court found no negligence on the part of the municipality because that plaintiff had swam their lots and knew the submerged wall was there. So as the court put it, the plaintiff's actions constituted an entire absence on his part of the use of reasonable care, and therefore the plaintiff was considered the sole author of his injuries. So in that case, obviously, the plaintiff was 100% liable, and there was no award that came from the owners of the pool. So you have to keep in mind when you hear the term contributory negligence that this applies only to the conduct of the plaintiff. The defense of contributory negligence comes into play where it's established that the conduct of the person was unreasonable or dangerous given the circumstances, and that it also could, their behavior contributed to the injuries they sustained. So what we can think about is not only do defendants have a duty to reasonably prevent foreseeable injuries, but participants in your programs and using your facilities are also under the same duty to prevent injury. So if you're lawyers for the defense, which I think, who's the defense, David and Spider, is that right? Awesome. So when your lawyer's defense and you're making your case, look at contributory negligence. Just a hint there. So another way a defendant can escape liability is informed consent, and this is shown on slide 31. So inherent risks, as we talked about, are risks that are normal or natural to an activity. They can't be eliminated without changing the nature of that activity. And all activities, even getting out of bed, have some level of inherent danger. When people participate in your activities, they acknowledge and accept these risks. And as we looked at in RM 102, Document to Manage Risk, an informed consent form raises awareness of the risks. So I think, David, you shared a good one for your programs. And when a participant signs an informed consent, they agree to and they assume the inherent risks of an physical risks of an activity. So you'll remember, and I'm going to pop this in here, participants do not agree to legal risks, okay, that are not inherent or part of the activity that they're doing. And those are risks such as improper supervision, faulty equipment or facilities, inadequate training of an activity leader. So they're agreeing to things like, yes, I know a walking program in the winter, it might be slippery, there's a risk of falling or slipping on ice. But if they're participating in your program, they're not agreeing to go with an activity leader who has no training and is completely blind to what the inherent risks are. So an informed consent form provides examples of the types of injuries that can happen in various recreation activities, and we looked at those in RM-102, so I won't go through this in too much detail. You know that there's certain information that should be included. You know that it's not a waiver, but it's the first part of the waiver form, and you also may recall that an informed consent form can be used for minors, but that we usually call it a parental consent form. You might also recall that an informed consent form is not a waiver, but it's always the first part of a waiver form. Okay, so you can include an informed consent form when you think it's important as part of a registration package and know that it's not a waiver, but it just might be something to help defer or move that risk or liability off your organization onto the person who's participating. So slide 32, so with informed consent, a participant accepts those physical or inherent risks. But a waiver or release of liability, as explained on slide 32, is different because, remember, it asks the participant to accept both physical and legal risk. So when a participant signs a waiver, they can participate in the program, but by participating, they're giving up their right to sue. So that's different. So read slide 32 and make sure you work through activity 8, because I'm just going to summarize it here, and then I will give you questions because I see that David's got his hand up. David, is your hand up about informed consent or about waivers?
How about both?
Okay, can I just go through the waivers, and or do you want to ask your question? Go ahead.
No, go right ahead. It's pertinent, but it's more looking to try and figure out a solution to what I see as a problem. But that's okay. We can deal with it later. Go for it.
Okay. Let's just wrap up this content and just hold your question, or you can type it in the chat so we don't lose it. Okay? Unless it's a really long one. So how do waivers work? And I know we've talked about this a bit, but let's look at it a little bit more. And we may need to come back to this on our last call as well if you have more questions. I think that the court case will also help you understand waivers. And if you want more information, go back into RM-102, Document to Manage Risk, and take a look at my reply to one of Peter's posts, because I gave him some resources that I think he found very helpful in understanding waivers a bit more. I can also bring those out and pop them in something so that you guys can see them too. So a valid waiver is a signed legal contract that may protect an organization in a negligence suit by transferring risk from the organization to the participant. So those are key words. May protect and by transferring. This means that by signing, the participant agrees to not hold the organization responsible for any damages that are inflicted on the participant, even if the damage was a result of negligence by the organization or one of its employees. So when I think about this, I really think twice now before I sign a waiver, because a waiver says, I'm going to accept inherent risks, but I'm also going to accept risks that the organization or the person offering the activity might be negligent and might cause me harm, and I don't care, I'm still going to participate. So definitely something to think about. So because a waiver asks someone to accept both the inherent and legal risk, it has to be a two-part document. It can't be blended into one. So it needs an informed consent part, and it needs a release of liability or waiver part. And it's the second part that the person signs that they agree to waive their right to sue. So a waiver is a contract and comes under contract law. So again, I know I've said this like three times, but a participant can give up their right to sue even if there was negligence, but they have to understand what they were signing. So if somebody can't read English and we have them sign a waiver and they don't understand what they were signing, it can't stand up in a court of law. So it's really important. In Canadian law, generally minors cannot sign away their own rights, and parents and guardians cannot sign away a minor's rights. What Peter found is that there's varying interpretations of that in different provinces and territories, and it seems that more and more people are using waivers with minors, not because they'll stand up in a court of law, but to deter parents from suing. So more as a deterrent. I think that that's a really important piece. When you choose to use a waiver, make sure it's developed by a lawyer or adapted from another waiver and then reviewed and approved by a lawyer. Most people don't have the ability to create a waiver with the correct legal wording that will stand up in a court of law. So although a signed waiver gives away the right to sue, it does not waive negligence, although I just said that. So generally, courts don't like waivers, but if they're administered properly, they might stand up in the right situations. So because of that, it's suggested, and you can see this on slide 34 and 35, that we use waivers for our high-risk program, so overnight trips. For your high-risk participants, like elders or people perhaps, with dementia or with disabilities or things like that, or with high-risk facilities like a rock climbing wall. So you can decide when to use a waiver by using the risk matrix that was introduced in RM 101. And Peter and David and Spider, you guys won't have seen this because you haven't taken RM 101 yet. But if you're familiar with anything like avalanche prediction and risk, it's pretty consistent with that. So I think that you'll be able to take a look at it and understand what it's explaining. So slide 34 and 30.
The three?
Pardon me?
Use waivers for high-risk programs, facilities, and?
And facilities. I'll pop that in the chat for you. So slides 34 and 35 explain that waivers should be administered before the activity begins. I think we all know that. But participants have to be able to read the waiver, right? So they have to read it, and some of those waivers are long. And they have to be able to ask questions about it. So there needs to be a staff person there who can answer questions and point out and make sure that the person understands that it's a legal document that they're signing and it gives up fundamental rights. Signatures on a waiver should also be witnessed. So that brings into question waivers that are done online when somebody's not there to interpret it and not there to help you sign it. David's nodding his head away, so I can see that you understand what I'm talking about. So very good. Transferring risk through a waiver is not as easy as it seems. So as slide 36 explains, so I've jumped through pretty far, if someone doesn't understand the purpose of your waiver or if it's administered incorrectly, it will not serve to transfer legal risk from the organization or the program leader to the participant. So that's why we don't want to use waivers in every single situation. Like, that's just way too much paperwork, and it's overuse. But be selective in how you use them, and if you think you need one, make sure you do it properly. There's no point in doing a waiver that you just chicken scratch on a piece of paper and hand to somebody to sign or send out in an email and they send back to you or something like that. So the last thing before we wrap up the call, I was just going to clarify the expectations around the required learning activity that's the case study and the court. But let me just ask you if you have any questions first. So, David, I know you had a question. Is it a long question or a short one?
No, actually, you answered it quite well when you said doing a waiver online, blah, 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 having a witness, blah, 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 that type of thing. They get quite long, so on. And the question that I have, and I don't want to talk about the problems I'm having with waivers, but you mentioned informed consent and a waiver cannot be blended into one document. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, they should be two parts. So the informed consent piece comes first, and the waiver comes second. Informed consent is that the person is aware of the risk, and you can do that by itself and have them sign it by itself. And then the waiver is that they will release you. It's a release of liability, so it's waiving their rights to sue.
But a single signature on one document that holds both parts is not the way to go.
I am not a lawyer. I would say that if you have them together and you provide the informed consent and the person reads all of it, and maybe your waiver has an initial beside, I have read the informed consent and recognize that there is inherent risk with this activity, and then goes on, I would think that a single signature might suffice, but I'm not a lawyer, so I would ask a lawyer that question.
Okay, so that's good. And like I said, you did cover the problems I'm having, and it would be nice to talk about potential solutions in terms of, it's quite a long waiver, and people don't like to stand around, especially in the cold, signing a waiver, and when you put it online, nearly none of them ever reply back with it.
Yeah, so, you know, a question to you or a suggestion perhaps, and I know Arpe has done this in the past and taken all of her documents and had them reviewed by a lawyer. Yes, it costs a little bit of money, but it gives you a huge peace of mind. You know, maybe you could check with a lawyer. Maybe there's a way to send the informed consent out with the registration form, and then it would just be attached again to the waiver, but they would agree in the waiver that they've already read the informed consent. I don't know if that's an option or not, but that might be a question to ask a lawyer. And you
much
could also,
like,
instead of... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, much like you see a checkbox when you're registering for a software program, you agree to terms and conditions. So if you have it attached that way, and then they check the box and you have it, if not checked, can't go any further. That's a forced check. And you see that all the time with software programs. So I'm just wondering how best to approach that, because I'm trying to save time on the program while at the same time meeting all the liability elements.
Yeah, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so I would ask a lawyer, and I would also have a lawyer review your waiver in light of the groups that you're working with and ask if there's any way to make it more succinct or concise, right? So you can, if you go to the very bottom of the learning event, I have an Explore More section, and in there, there's a how-to guide about waivers from the Sport and Law Strategy Group. They're an awesome organization. Spider, you mentioned, I think, or maybe, oh, I know who it was. Bill told me the other day on the phone. Bill's the executive director of Sport North, about working with Sport and Law. So that's a really great resource there. There's also the Canadian Legal Information Institute, which is a very interesting one where you can sort of find information. But ultimately, you would want to, if you're using waivers, I would suggest that you, your organization pays the money to have them reviewed by a lawyer before you actually use them.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, let me just quickly give a summary about what your required learning activity is going to look like, and then I'm happy to stay on the line longer and answer any questions that you have. So next week, we will not have a conference call. However, that 1 hour of time that you're not on the conference call could be, or ideally is, replaced with an hour of working with the person who's on the team of lawyers with you. So Spider and David working together, you guys might want to choose to work during the same time if you have it set in your calendar, or you might want to choose another time. And you might want to choose to use Zoom or the telephone or emails. It's up to you. And Peter, I'm going to leave it up to you to reach out to Kayla. And if for some reason she's not around and not participating, then we'll come up with some other options for you as well. So the RLA, or the required learning activity, and it's the due dates are different, so take a look. So you actually don't have anything due this Sunday, but you do have something due the following Friday. So you've got 7, 8, 9 days to do the next required learning activity. And what it is it's a case study that's going to help you apply what you're learning about legal risk. So we all know that people engage in dangerous activities every day. They scale sheer cliffs, fly down the sides of mountains, and the element of risk makes activities much more attractive to some people. However, sometimes that risk materializes and the results are tragic. So in general, when someone's injured in sports or recreation, the law doesn't hold anyone responsible. The injured person relies only on their private insurance and on the public health care system. But your RLA or case study involves a real case where an accident did happen and caused serious injury. The injured party sued for damages, claiming negligence. So your task is to determine, based on a set of facts that are provided, whether there is negligence, and if there is, how are you going to assign liability? So lawyers for the plaintiff, that's Peter and Kayla, and lawyers for the defense are Spider and David, and you have just over a week to prepare and present your case study, and you can find the detailed case study and the set of facts in activity number 7 under week 2. So click on the link for activity 7, and that's where you'll find it. And I'll just pop this in the chat too. And it looks like I'm a couple of minutes over, so if anyone has to hang up and leave, I'm totally okay with that. But I'm also happy to stay on the phone a little longer and answer. Oh, put my URLs in there, sorry, rather than the words.
Okay. I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead, Peter.
For the defense and the plaintiff, like is it like a mock trial or is it just like an assignment that you turn in?
So what we're going to do, that's a good question. So the case study introductions explain that if you're the lawyer for the plaintiff, you're going to argue that there is negligence, okay? And when you click on Activity 7, it says develop your case. There's a scenario review template that I want you to use. And it will help you recall the 5 key areas of risk. And then you're going to record your argument and case for negligence using, I have a worksheet called Lawyers for the Plaintiff Worksheet, and you have to, on that worksheet, indicate on what grounds there is negligence, who is being sued, and who is liable. And then you're going to post your worksheet and anything else that supports your case. And so the lawyers for the defense are going to argue that there's no negligence and you have the same resources, but they're a little different. So each of your groups will post in, let me just see which one it is. You're going to post it into the forum that says make your case, and it's number 10 under week 3. And then in week 4, your activity is to prepare for the conference call by reviewing what the other lawyers have posted. And on the conference call, we're all going to be the jury. So, David, you've asked who's going to be the jury. We're all going to be the jury together. Just because we have a smaller group of people. If I had a really large group of people, I would assign each person different things. But I find that it's actually more interesting to participate as the jury together as well.
Okay. Thanks.
So, what you'll see then under, if you're in the learning event, what you'll see under week 2, which is this week, you'll see case study instructions. And just try and read it, as I said, read by Friday, but try and read it and make sure that if you have questions, you ask me sooner rather than later. And that's by this Friday. Then next week, week 3, so nothing due on Sunday for this learning event. In week 3 then, you're going to work through what we've talked about today. You're going to prepare your cases, and it says on Wednesday, but you can choose a different date. So, David and Spider, it looks like you're already chatting and figuring out how you're going to connect. Because I can see David posted, Spider, how does your next week look at? And Spider, you've put your contact information. But maybe you guys can agree if you're going to meet at the same time or a different time. And then you'll use the prepare your cases and then make your case in the activities RLA for, number 10 forum. You can use that forum. I'll put a note in there. Do you have any questions? You can use that forum to ask me any questions as well. Any more questions? Go ahead, David. Is that clear as mud?
Definitely going to be a busy next 2 weeks.
Yeah, so it is, but when you open those worksheets, you'll notice they're actually really short.
Yeah, no problem.
So it doesn't have to be super complicated. I just want you to review the case study, okay? And all the worksheets are down at the bottom, like all the things that you can download are down at the bottom in activity number 7. And I've also popped some questions for you to consider down at the bottom as well. So you would start with getting the set of facts. And then here, I can pop this in here too. Okay, Peter had to go. So here's the different worksheets. So lawyers for the plaintiff, lawyers for the, and the case. So you can click on those links and you'll find it fairly quickly too. So I'll leave it, David and Spider, you guys go ahead and talk if you want to prearrange a time or if you just want to email or text back and forth. I can keep the call open until you figure that out. I'll just end the recording here though, I think.